So I will call the meeting to order at 2 o'clock. The first item of business is the consent agenda. If you guys want to look that over, and we just need a motion to approve the consent agenda.
Oh, and hit your.
So there you go.
So moved.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to accept the consent agenda. Is there any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. The consent agenda has been approved. The next item is the public forum. This is a time for members of the public to offer comments concerning matters not scheduled to be heard before the Board of Health. Is there anybody that has anything they want to bring forward at this time? Not seeing anybody. We will move down to additional items. Item number one should have been done in January. No, February. We didn't meet in January. February, we should have our election of officers. So having missed that, we need to conduct our election of officers. So I will entertain any motions for the position of chair.
I move the same officers as we have currently.
A second.
We've got a motion and a second to maintain the same officers. Yeah. See what happens when you don't show up. That we do currently. Any further discussion? All those in favor of keeping the current officers say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Congratulations, Dr. Passion. Number two, decision to require all septic contractors working in Story County to be a certified installer of on-site wastewater treatment systems. Oh, the vice chair is here.
The continuing vice chair.
Guess what? We just did an election of officers.
Just election.
And guess who got it?
A certification required within 3 years. I think we started this discussion last time, maybe, and we'll continue it. Who's going to lead the discussion? Margaret. You had said something at the Board of Supervisors meeting this morning that you had brought this up at your contractors meeting.
Yes, I had. And they seem to be okay with it, the contractors. There's always going to be a few that aren't interested in it. But in that annual contractor meeting, we talked about it, and no one said absolutely not. Let's see, the costs, Kathy just sat for that exam. It would be the same one that the contractors would be required to do. The cost of that for an individual is, $200 if you're a member, $300 if you're not a member of the Iowa Association. And then to sit for the exam, it's about $110 if you're, I'm sorry, $95 if you're a member and $110 if you're not a member. So it would cost $300 to $400 per person. That's a one-time thing. And then they would have 12 and a half CEUs per year, which DNAC is making it quite easy for them to get those continuing education credits. I think it's about time to do this. The state does not require that such a contractors be certified. Slowly, several counties are requiring that. And this is kind of the standard that all the other counties that have done this have adopted.
Are there any counties around us that have adopted it yet?
No one adjacent. Some of them have things like attend the Iowa meeting annually, things like that. Last time I had a map of it, I think there are about 8 counties in all that have that right now. And several that are considering it.
And is this something they have to do every year?
Take the test? No.
Yeah,
but they
the
do.
Is it the class and the test, is that a one-time?
One-time deal, but then they have continuing education requirements. Mm-hmm.
But what we're looking at is having them get that certification within within 3 years.
3 years is what we talked about last time. Yes.
Mark, what do you think about this?
I think it's a pretty good idea, actually, because it keeps them up to date on the new and upcoming systems that are coming out, and they're always making those better and revising the ones that are out there. So, really, if you don't keep up on it, you don't keep up on the latest. I mean, just like the new medicines, you know, the meds come out.
Right.
And so it's... And
so currently, anybody could put in a system.
That's correct, yeah. And oftentimes we'll have people asking for recommendations, and being county, you can't recommend. But if you had a list of folks that were certified, you could say, well, this, you know, go to this list.
Considering that my family had a very poor septic system put in on their property and had to have it redone, I think I'd be really in favor of this. In another county.
Of course.
What's our next step?
It would be public hearing, which would involve, you know, the whole steps, the putting it in the paper, and then the hearing, and then it would actually have to be before the Board of Supervisors and get into the county code that way. So probably, 3 years from when it's adopted?
Adopted by the Board of Supervisors.
3 years, yeah. That's plenty of time. Is that too much time? 3 years?
No, I mean, I think you can look at it a couple of different ways. Like you said, there's some counties that simply make them attend the class. I mean, you know, do we do that for a couple of 3 years, and then at the end of that 3-year period say, okay, now after this you have to be certified? Or do we give them the 3-year window to get their certification? I mean, I think it's a good idea. And it's like we talked last time, I mean, anybody could put in the system. You give a guy a shovel and you know, a backhoe, he can go put a shingle out to put in septic systems. Whether he should be doing it or not, it's a different question, but...
One thing you have to consider is whether or not homeowners can put in their own. And there's very few homeowners who can actually do this. But the problem that we run into is a homeowner who's buddies with a contractor. And if the homeowner says, well, he's just helping me, so technically I am doing it, and that helper is not a certified contractor, that's where you run into some gray areas. Some counties, when I sat for the exam, the guy next to me was a homeowner. He wanted to do his own system. He went through the trouble of getting certified just so he could do his own. The county was that adamant about homeowners not, you know, or having to be certified no matter who you are. So whether or not we allow homeowners who are not certified to do it, that's another question to address.
You see a lot of that, or much of it?
3 a year, maybe, at the most. What do you think?
Well, I know the plumbing code is that the homeowner can do their own plumbing as long as they take out a permit and then get it inspected by the... But they still have to take out the permit and pay for it, and it has to be done to code, but that's the way the plumbing code works.
And that's the way we do it also. And then as far as inspections go, we just make sure we're out there longer and
it's more time on your
it
part.
Does, it does.
That happens.
We don't like it when they do that.
You have to babysit them, sort of.
I guess I would question how we could require a homeowner to have a certification where if you live in the unincorporated areas of the county, you can wire and plumb your own house if you want to. I mean, the county currently doesn't have any requirements for any building codes or inspections. If an individual is going to build his own home, he can plumb that house himself and he can wire that house himself, if I'm not mistaken. I don't know if you don't have the mechanism in place to require an inspection or a permit to do that, how we can require a homeowner that's going to put in his own system.
I think the state electrical now, they do have,
on
the electrical side it is. We haven't got the plumbing side yet, but that's coming.
Coming, yeah.
Well, and that's probably a discussion that could continue with the Board of Supervisors, because ultimately that's who will, you know, they will approve whether or not they're going to adopt the ordinance. So we, and I think the other thing we need to discuss is the public hearing. Do we want to do a public hearing in 2 months in conjunction with the Board of Health meeting, or do you want to convene a special Board of Health meeting to do a public hearing in the evening?
I don't see where it would be necessary in the evening.
I think if, and a lot of times with the Board of Supervisors, if we can combine a public hearing with a regularly scheduled meeting, I think it's easier.
Mm-hmm.
I recommend that since we are required to do a public hearing, I would assume that 2 months from now we'd have plenty of time to make the notifications and
Yes. Have
the public hearing when we at our next Board of Health meeting.
Okay.
You think 3 years is too long, though? That seems like a long time.
It does seem like a long time, but I think if you want to look at something like, you know, letting them attend the class for, or requirement to attend the class for a year, I don't know, maybe 2 years is long enough. I mean, there are certain people that are going to complain about it regardless. They don't understand why they should have to do it, but if it's a $400 expense, and you know, they'll recoup that on one
referral from the list.
When it's a brand new requirement, I think 3 years actually is very fair. You know, when I think about when our requirements for licensing or keeping our board certification goes up, really we get like 5-6 years notice that, you know, it's gonna happen, and you know, let people know. Since this is brand new, I think 3 years actually, I think that'd be fair.
So I guess we're looking.
We need a motion.
I think we need a motion to for the Board of Health to require that we require the certification, and then after the public hearing, and it'll be the ordinance itself, I think, is what goes in front of the Board of Supervisors for adoption. So I think the first step is the board to adopt the policy, Board of Health to adopt the policy.
So I would like to make that motion that we approve a policy that all septic system
contractors
are certified within 3 years.
Second. We've got a motion and a second to require all septic contractors working in Story County to be certified as on-site wastewater treatment installers. Is there any further discussion? And to give them 3 years to get the certification. Is there any other discussion on that? Further discussion? Okay, hearing none, I guess I'll call for the vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. That motion carries. So, yeah, we probably should also note in there that we'll set the public hearing for this. And I don't have a calendar in front of me for the next Board of Health meeting.
Is
it June 5th? Yeah, June 5th. Okay, moving down under additional items, number 3, decision regarding the adoption of the Story County Public Records Policy. You didn't happen to bring a copy of that policy, did you?
I didn't. It's a good policy. It's just that we get, okay, it's requiring that any public request for information that comes in, we notify Sandra, no, Alyssa rather, Alyssa, of that, the type of information request, and you know, the turnaround time, those kinds of things. And that's fine for large requests, but we get requests for septic diagrams multiple times a week, and it seems like that is not the type of information that is meant by a public request, you know, sharing of the public information. So we were hoping that the board would ask that we didn't have to comply with that requirement for every single thing that comes down the pike, only large and I don't know how we would define that, but, you know, getting away from that daily information request, it just seems like that would just be a useless exercise.
Well, so just to kind of fill you guys in a little bit, the Board of Supervisors adopted a open records policy three weeks ago, and part of that was in conjunction with our new website, and we've also, there's a group that reviews county policies and ordinances, and it's a sunshine review is what it is, and we don't always get the best grade on that for our open records policy. We currently, or before we adopted the policy, we didn't have one person that kept track of all the requests. So if you wanted, say, some information from the recorder's office, you would go down to the recorder's office and you would request whatever public record you wanted, and they would grant the request, and there wasn't any way to real good way to track that. So what we did is we named our human resource director, Alyssa Wignall, as the the custodian of the request. If an individual is going to come in and request a record, they'll still go to that same office and make that request. However, now it's, whether it's by email or however they want to do it, but they need to notify Alyssa that the request has been made and what the request was. That way she keeps track of it, and we know, you know, that people's requests are getting granted. It really doesn't change anything for the people that are requesting the information. It makes it easier for the department and the county to know that they fulfilled that request. So what you're looking for is if somebody comes in and wants a diagram of the septic system.
That extra step of having to notify Alyssa about that information request be waived because it's really not within that spirit of that requirement.
I understand what you're saying, but I think what we probably need to do is get some more clarification on it and on exactly how to figure out what you want to be exempt from or what items you want to be exempt from.
Well, for the next meeting then, can I write up something that would show what we would want to be exempt from having to notify?
And I can work with you on that, and we can talk to Steve Owen about it and see. I mean, obviously the spirit of the policy is for public records, whatever that might be. Technically, I guess a diagram of the septic system is a public record. But, I think whether you're exempt or not, or whether we can figure out a better way, so whether you do it once a month or, once a week or once a month, we'll just have to figure out the best way to do that, because I think once we start letting different departments exempt themselves from certain requests, and I think we might be, get ourselves into trouble.
Undermining the policy.
Margaret, can you charge for giving this information out?
We can, especially if it's paper copies. I know that we're supposed to charge for those copies. Most of it's electronic that we send out. And we're just so glad that they're interested in pumping their tank. We don't want to discourage it, number one, by putting a fee on it. Number two, sometimes charging 50 cents, it's a lot more hassle than it's.
So you're not really concerned about the time it takes your office. What you're concerned about is the fact that you have to tell someone else that they're requesting that information. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes. Well, every little request that comes in, you have to remember, I've got to let Alyssa know that this guy wanted a picture of this septic. You know, and it's stuff that she,
there's a fee schedule laid out with the policy that, so much per copy, or, if it's not so much the health department, but other offices, the county attorney's office, or even the Board of Supervisors. If it's a large request, that can take, several staff hours in order to fulfill that request. And there's a fee. If it goes over so many hours, then, you could be charged for what the staff time was on that. So, but yeah, I can work with you, and we can come up with some way to figure it out.
Okay.
So.
Thank you.
Moving down the agenda, we go to quarterly reports and discussions. Number one is homework, regular report. Terry Olinger and Eileen Mullen.
Sure.
Do we have a new board member now?
Which one?
Well,
yeah, we have. There's two of them that are interested in it. So the Board of Supervisors is going to have to.
You're going to introduce them.
Yeah.
Make the mention.
Mm-hmm.
Eileen Mullen. I'll start with the Board of Local Board of Health financial report, and I think I'll just point out a couple of things from the report. We're getting towards the end of the year, and you'll see of the grant dollars funded that in all of our areas we've spent nearly all of the grant dollars. And we'll have, I guess I just want to say, no problem spending those monies throughout the rest of the year here. The one thing I'm going to comment on, unless you have questions after you look at this, is on the first group, skilled nursing and health promotion. Under comments, we have seen, excuse me, of the clients that were served, 215 of them were discharged, and 156 of them, which is 73%, met their goals. I've been noticing a decline in the number of people meeting the goals at discharge. And discharge can be because they went into the hospital instead of staying in the home. It can mean they chose to go to hospice. It can mean that they went into a nursing home. So the next board meeting, I'm going to bring to you the breakout of that and just talk a little bit about what that breakout is. In the meantime, just I'll give you three things that come to mind of what we're doing in home health right now to help be more successful at keeping people into their homes. One of them is we are sending two nurses at this point in time with the idea of sending some more this year to be health coaches. And health coaches is sort of the trend and has been found to be somewhat successful in where nurses go into the home and spend a great deal of time working with the client, understand a little better about what their goals are instead of what our, and helping to translate it into their terms instead of our medical terms. So if our goal would be for them to keep their blood sugar down, but yet they, you know, that everything they eat and buy and it has nothing to do with keeping their blood sugars down, we'll investigate and work with them and their family to find out the barriers to success. And anyway, it's a more friendly approach. We hope to see some outcomes with that. Second, we are sending people, some of our nurses, to be certified in cardiology or cardiac care, and a large amount of our clients are cardiac-related congestive heart failure, and those are the ones that go back into the hospital most frequently. And so we're hoping with that initiative that also will help keep people in their home a little bit more. As you can see here, we also had a few clients that did go back into the hospital that were congestive heart failure. And then the last I wanted to report to you on that is we have a transitional care program. And this transitional care program has twofold, where we have a telehealth unit that we're able to give to clients when they're in our service free of charge, where they can daily we can connect through the telephone lines to find out certain components of the health care, monitor them that way, and let physicians know when there's changes in advance to them going into the emergency room. And secondly, we are now going into the home of all patients who are discharged from Mary Greeley Hospital that have a diagnosis of congestive heart failure, COPD, pneumonia, and acute MI. And we're going into the home, doing an environmental check, doing med reconciliation, making sure they have the right medications, and a few other things, again, hoping to identify what other resources they might need to help keep them in the home. So that's just an update on some of those components. Then I just wanted to go just very briefly
I can find it here. I'm not sure how to get rid of the little on the left column. Oh, okay. Okay, there you go. Let's figure out how to get to them. Wanted to update you very quickly about our community health plan, which the board has approved our health improvement plan and where we're at year to date. And this is just a reminder that the community health plan is just a huge part of what our public health does, our Board of Health here. And we've been very, in this county, we've been very aggressive and progressive, I think, in what we're doing with our community health plan. And as a reminder, every 5 years, we are to lead, it is the Board of Health is to lead the communities in what our a health community plan, an assessment, and a plan. And we did that this year, and as a result, there was a group of us that are on a team, and that's YFS, Jerry Bug, Deb Shield-Roth, Dr. Greg Wilk with ISU, Ron Smith at Mary Greeley, myself, and Gene Cressy with United Way, where we helped to lead these community health assessments, gather money, if you will, so we can have a great assessment here in Story County. You can find this once again at this website and through that password. And if you're interested in that and can't find yours, I'll be happy to give that to you. Just an overview. Okay, let me back up. As a result of the Story County assessment, we found several actions, opportunities in which this board has approved and you've been given updates to. What Story County or this group decided is that, okay, we have this wonderful needs assessment. We've identified different coalitions that are working on the different needs within the county. So how can we sustain this? How can we keep this going? So we have developed the Story County Quality of Life Alliance. This Story County Quality of Life Alliance, fondly called SQALA. Everybody hates that name, but it's easier. Our overview, our vision is to build on the collective powers of community initiatives to improve the quality of life for the county. So our purpose is through this alliance, information from all these coalitions and ideas and resources are going to be shared. It's going to be an opportunity for this alliance, for all of these coalitions to pull together and get grant dollars and make sure we're using those grant dollars most wisely. We're going to continue throughout the next couple of years, look at the community needs assessment and reevaluate what are some more priorities that we need to tackle, and look and see what are some emerging health and social needs that we have at this point not identified or feel we're now ready to move forward with. You can't see this very well, but the Story County Quality of Life Alliance is made up of partner organizations and community coalitions. The leadership group is that group of us that originally got together and to help put together the needs assessment for the county, and it's the names I just read off. McFarland Clinic is represented on here, many organizations, and if you want to copy this to see it a little more clearly, you sure may have it. School districts, Richmond Center, United Way, Salvation Army. Just a great, great source of information, individuals with information. We had our first meeting in February, and there was some really great dialogue. We plan on these meetings to be informational, not just a reporting off time, but informational and also a time to develop more strategies. We have a website. This is the website. We hope to not only have
meeting times and minutes that other people's lives and activities that we're doing towards this kind of so that the whole community can have to get that. And we'll link this on to the New Story County website.
Will not use our time today to go through anything else. I had planned to start some using some of this meeting time to update the Board of Health, to review some of the core functions and essential public health standards, because I know that some of you have been on the board for quite a while and others are new. So I thought it might be a good time, and we'll have another new person to start just reviewing what these are again. And so I think next meeting I'll start that, and as well as I have a easy little assessment that each of you can have, and we can identify where you believe our needs are for education and the Board of Health, and we can use that throughout the rest of the year. I think I'll get that to Terry now.
Terry Olinger, the Story County Public Health Nurse, and my report actually is rather short. Most of our January and February was spent reporting on communicable diseases. We had several, 11 total, and including an active TB case, a pulmonary case who passed away about a week ago. And actually, we got a new case of pulmonary TB today. So TB seems to be on the rise in our county anyway. We seem to be, you know, keeping cases of that.
Associated with the university? The second case?
The case we received today, yes. The case who passed away, no. So that the case who passed away is an elderly gentleman who lived in Hamilton County. He came to Story County temporarily for a couple weeks. Well, actually, we had him for 4 weeks to stay with a relative, then decided to move back to Hamilton County with another family member. So he went back and forth. So we shared him for a little while. We had a case. We had two cases of spinal TB, one TB meningitis, and that case went back home to his home country, and will be back in July. So that's our TB update. On the emergency preparedness front, the last 2 months as I said, concentrated mainly on communicable disease reports, but there is a governor's conference coming up in April, the 17th and 18th, if any of you are interested in attending. There's also an Iowa Preparedness and Response Training Summit, and that is being held the 25th, 26th, 27th of April in Des Moines. We did, at our last emergency preparedness meeting, we were given a presentation by the state of Iowa regarding the new grant coming in 2012. And they discussed aligning hospitals and public health in one grant. So there'll be one grant award with two funding streams. So we'll be sharing that one grant with hospitals, and public health will share that. And that grant will focus on the 15 capabilities, and it will be a 5-year grant. So at the next meeting, I can go into a little more depth on that grant as it gets closer to that time. We continue to work on our plan. We added a mass casualty section about 3 weeks ago, so that was big to finish that up. And that plan will be coming out. We'll have that ready probably the end of August. So Our childhood immunization clinics, I did pass out a summary of immunization service contract objectives. Just a few things about that. What we do is we set our what we want our goals and objectives to be, and that's on the left-hand side, on the left-hand column, and then on the right-hand column is what data, what actually happened that year. And I know in the first one, just a side note, that these numbers are private and public institutions. What they do, the data that counts is, one, it has to be, we have to be an immunization home, which means you're responsible for a child's immunizations. And the second one, they need a zip code. So if you don't have a zip code, the data's not there. A child's immunizations aren't counted. So the data, I don't, you know, we've talked about if this is really good data to use because, you know, immunization rates are usually higher than this. I know our accomplishment was 74%. We wanted to be above the national goal of 90%, but actually 74% does not sound that great, but it was the fifth highest in the state. We were tied for the fifth highest. So, you know, actually we did well. The highest percentage in the state was 81%. So.
Where was that?
You know what? I am not sure. I thought of that on the way over here, which state or which county. I can get to that. I have it on my desk. I just don't have it with me. But it was 81%, which to me seems low. But again, if you don't have those two components, and a lot of our immunizations at Homeward aren't counted because we are an in-between. We are a gap filler. If someone just lost their insurance policy because they lost their job, you know, people come to us. And so we're not responsible for all that child's immunization. We usually are responsible until that family picks up insurance with the next job or whatnot, and then, you know, they go back to the physician. So we're kind of, you know, that's just one example. We're kind of a gap filler. So a lot of our kids that we see, you know, we're not their immunization home. And another example is teenage girls and boys with HPV. A lot of insurance companies don't cover HPV, so they come to Homeward for that vaccine because it's expensive to pay for that privately. And then they go back to their provider for other vaccines. So that's just a little side note there. The next goal was using COCASA, which is a self-assessment tool provided by Iowa Department of Public Health. And we can't really tell you much about that one because Mary Greeley Medical Center software hated that program. I worked on it for a couple days. Sherry worked on it for a couple days. It never worked. So I just called them and told them, we're not going to spend any more time on it. So we never did do our self-assessment. That was one of our objectives. The next goal was HPV. We wanted to increase our percentage by 10%, and actually we decreased our percentage by 10%, so we dropped to 22%. And 22% is actually the national average of adolescent females finishing three doses of HPV, and again, you know, the data is a little skewed there. One of our weaknesses this year is because we had a turnover with our immunization clerk. We had our first clerk left, and now our second clerk has left, and we're interviewing to replace her. So we've had a little bit of turnover there, and our reminder recall, you know, will be improved next year when we get someone trained in and able to do that on a regular basis. Our storage documents is another objective. We carry that out. We check our fridge twice a day. We have an alarm system on weekends and after hours if the fridge gets out of bounds. It goes off and calls us at home. So. And according to our wastage rate was higher this year than last year, too. It was 10%, but that included our flu vaccine that was sent back, which that hurt us. And as far as entering our clients into IRIS, we've just done very well with that. 98% of our clients were entered within 5 days, so that goal was met. So that is our immunization year-end objectives for 2011.
Barry, explain to me again what you mentioned about with the zip code issue on documenting immunizations. And
they require, they being the immunization program, because the zip code tells them if the child lives in your county. Yes. So they do require a zip code. And
they're not getting their zip code in, or?
Well, some people, no. The zip code hasn't, but our issue with public health isn't really the zip code, it's the immunization home. Because, again, you know, McFarland-Peeds has most of the kids. We provide an immunization home for some people, but not the vast majority. So
I'm thinking about data and county and stuff. So do we need to put in, are we like not putting in a piece of information into IRIS?
Sometimes, yes. Sometimes that is not put in. The zip code is not. It's left off. So, and we're trying harder to get that, you know, we've discussed it and we're working harder when people fill their sheets out to make sure the zip code's on there. And we have called parents back after, you know, they've been, if we can't find the zip code, we, you know, call them.
But the flu vaccine's in IRIS, right?
Yes. Our VSD, our kids, yes.
It's hard to tell what percentage of your patients are immunized against influenza. And we really, I've been trying to get our people to pull up the data within our group, and they have a very, very difficult time, and I kept wondering what maybe it is the zip code.
That could be. Very well could be.
Great to know, because the published data on flu vaccine rates are really just estimations, and they can only get really good rates when everything is done through the public health.
Right. The other thing that hurts us, too, with incomplete theories are our college population, and the AIMS is very transient. You know, you have students coming in, they have, you know, babies while they're here or bring young children with them, and then after a year or two they get their master's or doctorate and they're gone. So that counts against us. Some of these kids have, you know, they leave, move on, and their records are incomplete when this data comes out. So, yeah. So those are some barriers that make us look bad, you know, worse on paper than it actually is. Now, when you look at our immunization assessments for school, they're very high. I think they're 99%. So, but that data is consistent across the board. There are kids who are students, you know, registered students at schools. So, you know, it doesn't matter about their zip code. Doesn't matter about, you know, their immunization home. That data is very high. So,
and every time that insurance companies have looked at particular immunization rates, it's always very high when insurance companies look at it, you know, at least in our area. And but again, our national data is not okay. I'm going to talk to Ann Kohler about that.
But Terry, what's the university's responsibility as far as the students coming in, the foreign students, and then the, if they're bringing their kids, as far as the immunizations and the TB, are they checking, aren't they supposed to be doing some of that?
Usually with international students, they have physicals before they come over, and then they'll bring a set of chest x-ray, and then the university has tried very hard to test their students coming from other countries. It's not the law that they have to have an international student physical, but Iowa State tries to rule with an iron fist. They do a very good job getting the majority of their people in with. And, for example, the student with TB meningitis, he had been here a year or two before his TB developed, but that's tuberculosis. It can be very slow, you know, growing in the body until it manifests symptoms.
But they were didn't for all the international students, they weren't they requiring those physical?
They're not required, but they call and have them come in. Yeah.
But I thought they were requiring that to get on their health insurance, so they had their own health insurance through the university, right?
Well, I don't think it's required, but it is strongly encouraged that they do. They can't make people come in to get those.
No, but they are required to have the health insurance, though.
The students are, yes.
Right.
And so they have caught a lot of TB at early stages by doing that. They do an awesome job of getting the students in. But there are those people that they'll be here, they'll come here, and then, you know, a year or two in, they get sick. And so that's what happens. That's, you know, really something, you know, beyond their control. But they bring x-rays, and then the students with abnormal x-rays and those symptoms are checked by a physician and x-rayed here. So if they're retested for tuberculosis and they use quinacridone gold, which is the gold standard, and if that quinacridone gold test is positive, then they go on for a chest x-ray automatically and, you know, given the choice of having INH therapy. So they do the best they can, yeah. Any other questions? Okay.
Right. Thank you. Okay, is there anybody here for Jerry Bug from YSF? Because she's on our agenda. Okay, just real quick, I know there's at least one of our potential candidates for the Board of Health here. Was the other individual here also, or just if you want to just come down here really quick and introduce yourself.
Down here real quick and get a name.
The other individual is Dr. Gail Brown,
right.
And we actually work at the same center.
I'll just
okay. My name is Dr. Glenda Dvorak. I am a veterinarian at the College of Veterinary Medicine. I'm the assistant director for the Center for Food Security and Public Health there, and so we do a lot of educational training for veterinarians on public health issues, veterinary public health issues. You just want to know more about me. Let's see. I do have a master's in public health from the University of Iowa. I'm board certified from the College of American College of Veterinary Preventive Medicine. And I'm just kind of interested in, I'm on several national and state veterinary public health committees, but I'm not involved locally. And so I think this will be a good opportunity for me to not only share my expertise, but just kind of see what's going on. So far, the meetings so far have been very interesting. Lots of things going on that I was not aware of. So
they're not always as interesting.
Okay. but what I was going to add, Dr. Gail Brown, we work at the same center, and so it was kind of like between the two of us.
Okay.
And so she stepped down.
It's actually an unexpired term that we're trying to fill, and I was going to look today, but I don't know when the term actually expires. So, and the process is that you're actually appointed by the Board of Supervisors to serve on the Board of Health. So, and unfortunately, neither one of the other two supervisors are available this afternoon to meet with you. So,
okay.
So, we'll get through this sooner or later and get somebody appointed to fill our fifth position. But I certainly appreciate your interest and the time you took this afternoon to come over and. Okay, number three on our list is the Iowa Department of Public Health Review Board of Health Policies and Procedures, Carmelie Stone and Heather Bombe. One thing I'll kind of interject here is through kind of the, I guess through the budget process for the Environmental Health Department, and also there were some questions about the budget that was approved by the Board of Health and ultimately went to the Board of Supervisors for the final approval. There was also some questions about the Who did you find out? Of Dorothy's term. So the term would just be until the end of the year, and then whoever's chosen will be, would, if they wanted to serve again, would be reappointed. And that, are they 3 year? Five? I can't remember.
3 year.
3 year terms. Okay. And there's also been some questions about whether or not it's a conflict of interest to have a board of supervisor member serve on the Board of Health. I wasn't at all sure about any of the history with any of this. I did check with Jane Halliburton, and I also had a conversation with Dr. Kluge, and you told me that you had served as the chair of the Board of Health for a number of years, and I believe Jane Halliburton was the first actual supervisor that that served on the board, and that was sometime in the mid-80s that the same
like 10 years ago.
So there's been some questions about that. I've been assured that there is no conflict of interest in having a board of supervisor member serve on the Board of Health. I certainly am not married to this position. When I started on the Board of Supervisors, we divided up the, I think there's 16 or 17 different boards and commissions that the three supervisors share. And it's kind of a, it was, basically it was a luck of the draw that I was, that I'm sitting here today. Came to my first meeting and was promptly elected chair of the Board of Health, because I was told that, well, it's always the Board of Supervisors that serves as the board chair. So, okay. But I have found out over the past year and however many months that it's actually worked out fairly well. I guess maybe, and maybe Dr. Kluge can talk to this a little bit better than I can. I think it would be very difficult for an individual to serve as the chair of the Board of Health that, that didn't have day-to-day contact with either the Board of Health employees or Eileen from Homeward or the Board of Supervisors or the Auditor's Office on how things work. I'm assuming that it was chosen to be this way because it was a good conduit, and there was some consistency in how things ran. And if you guys are volunteers, I mean, I'm on the clock, and you guys are volunteers, and I think you told me that you spent quite a bit of your time in front of the Board of Supervisors for various reasons, and I think it's worked out fairly well. I know there are some questions about, you know, does the Board of Supervisors have the authority to not approve something budget-wise that the Board of Health that the Board of Health approves? And I've been informed that, I've learned this as we go. The Board of Supervisors funds the Environmental Health Department. They appropriate the funds, and they allocate those funds. So I guess that's why I'm here. It's been interesting, and I'm glad I'm here. And I think, you know, maybe whether Heather or Carmel want to comment anything along those lines, or just kind of give us a refresher as exactly what our duties are and why we're here. But that's kind of was my take on this, and that's my understanding, and that's why you guys are here today for us. So.
From my standpoint, this has worked out a lot better than the other arrangement. I mean, it saves everybody a lot of time, I think the supervisors as well as the rest of us. And I think everybody's a lot more informed than trying to go secondhand back and forth all the time.
A lot of counties where the Board of Supervisors, a Board of Supervisors sits on the Board of Health. Sometimes they're the chair, sometimes they're not. Communication is the key. So having that, you sit on, you are a member, but you're also a liaison, and it works out well.
It's on. I think the light just doesn't work. Yeah. So
I think that's kind of what Heather and I thought when we were talking about today and how we would kind of move through this, is that Heather has a presentation.
Sure.
And so we thought we'd go through that. And then if there were remaining questions that you might have for us, then we are happy to answer those questions after she gets done. So.
Very good. Thank you.
Heather Bombi with the Iowa Department of Public Health. I'm the Regional Community Health Consultant for Region 1, which is Central Iowa. Mr. Suit, I apologize. A lot of what I'm going to talk about today you got in my boring hour and a half, 2-hour orientation that you...
It'll be a good refresher.
So So this is just a very broad summary. I know the agenda says policies and procedures, but those are really local decisions. We're kind of going to talk more about today about just roles and responsibilities and where you can find some things. Okay. So in your packet, the first thing that you'll find behind the PowerPoint is just Chapter 137. That's the Iowa Code. And then behind that is the Iowa Administrative Code, which is the rules. Every department, every state department has rules that go along with their laws, and that's Chapter 77. So that's printed out for you there. So 137 describes the law, 77 describes the rules. The membership is defined within the code as well. As Mr. Tu explained, the County Board of Health is appointed by the Board of Supervisors. A Board of Supervisor member may or may not be appointed. It's just whatever the Board of Supervisors prefers. Five members make up the Board of Health, one of which must be a licensed physician. The terms are for 3 years. You may be reappointed forever. Some counties...
You will be.
Not to scare you away, Glenda, but... some counties have bylaws. It's certainly not a requirement or anything, but some counties do have those, as long as they don't conflict with 137 or 77, and they have limitations on their terms. I don't believe that you have any bylaws here in Story County, so you can be here forever. It's nice if whoever is on the Board of Health has some experience or education related to public health experiences, and that could be anything from veterinary medicine to environmental health to nursing to community engagement, any sorts of experiences would assist. As far as meeting goes, the meetings have to be open, public meetings, sunshine advisory laws go along with that. Meetings used to just be required to be four times a year. Now they're six times a year. Minutes of Board of Health meetings need to be submitted to IDPH, Iowa Department of Public Health, once those are approved. And then also submit a member list annually. And I think it's Eileen's office. Someone from there takes care of submitting that to us. Then elect at least a chairperson. Some boards elect other officers as well, but at least a chairperson needs to be elected. From 137.04, powers and duties of the local Board of Health, enforce state health laws and rules, make and enforce the rules and regulations for the protection of public health. If necessary, employ persons, as Mr. Tu talked about, they are the employers for the Environmental Health Department. You may provide some population-based and personal health services, and then may also provide environmental health services. The three core functions, those are listed out in that brochure that was in your packet. It's assessment, policy development, and assurance. And the assessment piece relates back to what Eileen was talking about with the Community Health Needs Assessment and Health Improvement Plan that's done every 5 years. It's not necessarily that you as a board do that assessment, but you have to assure that it's done and have some input as far as what the public health goals and are for your county. Develop policies to make sure that the interest of the public is being served. And then just assure that the goals that you want are being provided, either by encouraging other outside entities to perform those services, by passing, recommending any regulations, or by providing those services directly. So just kind of a overall summary of your authority. Code says you have jurisdiction over all public health matters within your county. So that's a pretty broad scope that you have to tend to. Those public health matters could range from home visits from nurses to health education provided throughout the county, and to environmental health issues that come up. Again, you're going to assess the county's public health needs through your community health needs assessment, determine any community health or any public health priorities, determine what your needs are within your community, and then either employ or contract staff to carry those out, and oversee the public health agency as the governing entity, or direct the public health services like you do with Eileen's department at Mary Greeley. You don't necessarily govern, you don't govern her agency, but you subcontract with them to provide that function. The relationship between local boards of health and public health providers and your community partners is probably the most important part of what you do. All IDPH contractors, those who hold a contract with the department, are required to link or communicate with you. So if you have an agency that comes to you and says, we want to apply for a grant, will you give us a letter of support? And that's the only time that you ever see that agency, that's not appropriate. They need to know from you what your expectations are as far as them coming back and reporting to you. So as a Board of Health, you can determine what works best for you as far as how those agencies are going to report off. Do you want to require them to come quarterly and report? Do you want them to send written reports ahead of time? Or do you want to do a combination of both? But if they want your support when they're asking for money, then you need to see them at other times throughout the year. And then just a gentle reminder that the Board of Health doesn't have governing responsibilities to contractors. And then finally, successful boards of health are successful because of open communication and clear expectations. So as far as employees go, you can do that through clearly defining those expectations through job descriptions and performance evaluations, agency reports, things like that, and just talking to them and asking questions. And then for your contractors and community partners, again, read those subcontracts that you sign. They're brought to you, and you need to sign those, but make sure you're reading through them. Ask agencies for linkage reports so that you know what they're doing to what they're doing with the money that they're getting, and ask them questions. And that's that. So we'll just kind of open it up to questions or concerns that.
Three things. Is it up to the local board to decide if they can take votes or have meetings electronically?
Electronic meetings are allowed. You just have to still follow the open meeting laws as far as posting the agenda. And there has to be a site where the public could come and listen in on what you're doing.
Simple votes can we take without doing that, say we want to approve a contract or something?
Any action that's taken has to be a public meeting.
That's where the difficulty comes when a board like this only meets every other month. I mean, there's certain things that come up that, you know, if you need approval for, other than to call a special meeting, I would assume that technically if something like that comes up, we probably need to call a special meeting in order to get the to satisfy the open meetings law and to get the vote that we need.
But you could do it by telephone conference, by what you're telling me.
You could,
you
sure.
You could set up a telephone conference here, and we could all just call in.
But it'll still have to be posted.
Right. But the thing is, but taking a vote, that's what Dr. Kluge was asking. Many times we just want to vote and send our votes in by email.
Which we could do by email. Yeah. Do you approve this, yes or no?
Now, if you're taking an action, it still needs to be an open public meeting, but it can be done electronically as long as there is some place that the public can come and see or hear that you're taking a vote.
During the time that it's happening.
So you can't take the vote and then report on the vote later?
No.
Currently, we don't have the ability to do that live. I mean, the audio from this meeting will be on the county's website here just tomorrow. But we don't have the ability to stream the audio so nobody can listen. I mean, it can't be listened to as it's happening.
But if they set it up as a conference call, so if a telephone was here,
but that wouldn't serve our purpose. What we're talking about is being able to review the notes, being able to review the policy, and then like at 10 o'clock at night, putting my vote in.
Yeah.
But you can't do that. Okay.
Eileen has a contract. She needs to get approved by tomorrow. So how do we do that?
It's a digital
signature.
Same
contract we had last year. So we either vote yes or no.
Is it our contract? Oftentimes what they'll do is send it out ahead of time and ask for a review, which is not an action, but just review, and then you officially vote to approve it at your meeting. I think that you reviewed it through email, and then you'll approve it today.
That's what we did at the consent agenda.
Well, I think we just have to be aware of the wording that we use, short of setting up a conference call.
Our bureau isn't going to be picky. We know that they have reviewed it ahead of time. Yeah. And it doesn't, this application, it's not a contract, it's an application, so it doesn't require a signature, it just has an approval date.
They're on that one? Okay, the second question is your requirements for membership on the board, there's no gender requirements in it? We could all be male, or we could all be female, or in between, or
in between. It's my understanding that the state requires that we try to attempt to gender balance the board.
It's not specified in 137, but and I can't recall what that is. Probably ISAC would be able to do that, but yeah, we're supposed to try.
And there was a minimum number on the board, but can we exceed that minimum number?
Yes.
Anybody else have any questions while we're here? Margie, you should probably go to a microphone. There's a couple of spare ones up here.
Currently, the City of Ames has a Board of Health, as does Story County have a Board of Health, a local Board of Health. And we've come upon some instances where we need to know if Story County has jurisdiction within the City of Ames because they clearly have their own Board of Health. Those instances include complaints from tenants about a sewage backup. It includes septic system inspections. What else? Lead inspections, things like that. And we are wondering if we even have the right to go in a Ames Board of Health jurisdiction to do those kinds of activities.
For my information, Margaret, but the City Board of Health is the City Council that magically becomes the Board of Health.
That's correct. And I have a copy of the ordinance, and it's very clear in there that there is indeed a City Board of Health that is.
Yeah, but I mean, they just switch their roles.
Yes, yes. Let me get that.
Well, and this came up when Margaret gave her report today to the Board of Supervisors. There's a complaint about a sewage backup in the City of Ames. In a rental apartment. And we also had a complaint here a few months ago about bed bugs in the City of Ames. And, well, the City of Ames didn't have any mechanism to inspect. It was a shelter. And, well, all they inspect is money has to change hands in order for the City of Ames to inspect any type of a rental facility or a hotel or a motel. But any type of a shelter where money doesn't exchange hands and somebody can spend the night there, they don't have any mechanism to inspect those.
Well, they no longer have a sanitarium.
Right, they don't have a sanitarium, and here we are with a complaint from a tenant in a rental facility in the City of Ames that they're not getting any satisfaction from the city, so they turn to the county health department. I mean, I have some concerns about, you know, where do we draw the line? I mean, it just would seem a little odd to me that this a city with over 50,000 people in it doesn't have any mechanism to inspect any health issues. I mean, they'll inspect a rental property to make sure everything's up to code as far as so they can collect the landlord can collect the rent. But when health issues come up, they don't have the mechanism.
Not the restaurant inspection either.
Right. They lost that. He retired, and they were going to fill that position, and the Department of Public Health says you don't need to. We'll do it. Yeah.
Is the city
going to
fill that position?
No, they can't.
They can't. So the state's going to do it.
State's going to do it.
So I believe when this came up before, because I don't believe that the Department of Public Health realized a while back that there was a Board of Health in Ames, that the two that we recognize is City of Ottumwa in Wapello County, and then City of Council Bluffs in Pottawatomie County. And so I think that at least my supervisor and Heather's were surprised that this was here. And so when I asked them about their discussions that they had about what do we do with this, they were under the understanding that they were going to dissolve this, or this was going to be taken off the books. So they did talk to our Assistant Attorney General, but they didn't have a big discussion about it because they thought that it was going to be taken off. And so if you would like us to revisit that again, we can if this is going to, if they're going to keep this on the books as is. Because they were under the understanding that they were going to dissolve themselves is what Ken Sharp had told me.
And that was that right after Kevin Anderson retired? Was that same time frame?
It probably was. Now, when I just asked, I just asked Ken a couple of days ago where this was left, and that's where he told me it was left. And so they haven't talked about it more recently than that. So I know when Heather and I looked at Chapter 137, it looked a little vague because I think it says a city has
jurisdiction within the city.
Yep.
The county has jurisdiction
in the county.
In the county. Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
In the county.
Right. And so, yeah, and so it didn't have a defining line of if you have, you know, something in the city, the county can't go in, you know, and so it's not that specific in there. So I'm happy to go back
and ask for further discussion on it.
I think it was kind of news to, I know it was news to the mayor.
Yes, it was. Yeah.
I'm sure it would be news to most of the city council members to find out that they're actually the Board of Health members also for the city.
Yeah, and I did try to get an Ames representative to this meeting, and I don't believe I see anyone here doing that. So,
now,
they don't even have someone to man that position.
They required to? The city of Ames? They're not required? So,
I think the problem I have is if the city says, well, we just don't want to do it, now it becomes the county Board of Health problem. And I guess maybe I have a little problem with that. I mean,
when the restaurant inspection, is the state doing it? In fact?
Yeah, inspections and appeals.
They are doing it, the state.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And that would be your restaurant, your hotel, motel inspections is what they are doing.
Everything but convenience or in grocery stores.
I guess I don't know that for sure. If they're not, do you know who is?
Well, somebody else does it for grocery stores,
okay.
I believe. I know Kevin Anderson wouldn't do the, like, Hy-Vee for their, somebody from Omaha or somebody out of there would come over and do it.
I'm not sure what took place once Kevin
left. I think it was somebody from the state that did those. He didn't have jurisdiction over them, just the restaurant.
Well, I think what we would like to know is we'd like to know what our responsibilities are. And if the city of Ames doesn't pick it up and doesn't want to do it, then are we going to be called in to do it? And I think that would be really nice to know. If they've decided not to have a city board of health, then I think it would fall upon us.
I think it'd be a really good conversation to have with county attorney, city attorney, you know, kind of get everybody in the same.
We've had that conversation.
Yeah, I have tried and tried to get them to come to the table, and it seems like it's not doable. I guess my next suggestion would be for the Board of Health Chair to make a presentation to the Ames Council, City Council, who are also the Board of Health. And then enforce them into a decision that way.
Well, yeah, I mean, I can tell you what their decision is going to be.
It's all yours.
Yeah. If they're not currently doing it now. I don't believe they've done it in recent memory. But I mean, it's like the complaint on the bed bugs or the backed up sewer.
And how about Eileen's contract, and what is your service area? Does that specifically include Ames? Mm-hmm. Like when you, is it population-based? Your grant, is it population-based? Like how much? Okay. It wouldn't make any difference with our contracts. Okay. I didn't know if the amount of money you got was per capita or if it was just a block of money per county or... It's based on a formula which includes county population. So, and it includes Ames? Yeah. Okay. That's how you wrote it up. So it would include it.
The contracts that we have in environmental health are pool tattoo and tanning. Contracts, and Hardin County does yours here in Story, and that includes Ames. It includes the whole county, and then grants to counties is the well testing, well plugging, well rehab contract, and that would include the whole county as well. So,
and there's the 2080 agreement with DNR for well permitting, and that includes Ames also.
At two borrowers.
Tattoo is also Hardin County. So if you do the pool, tattoo, and tanning is all under one contract, and currently Hardin County holds that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So maybe we're just going to end up doing it. I guess I don't know. I think you're right. It's probably a conversation we need. I mean, another conversation we need to have with the city attorney and the county attorney and the city administrator. And just,
well, it appears you got to go there because in the past when they had a sanitarium, we, our people could work together at that level.
Right.
But that's gone now.
So. Well, I had a conversation with the city administrator over the whole bed bug thing, and he was kind of surprised that the city didn't have any mechanism to address that. And he said, well, that's maybe something that we need to talk to the council. I think since they've lost their sanitarian, there's probably a lot of things that they're not.
Yeah, that really wasn't a health... he wasn't really a health inspector.
No,
Kevin
no, he did
restaurant.
Strictly restaurant. And food,
so
yeah.
Anything other than that, he had nothing to do.
So that hasn't changed.
So I think the county is in charge
of
that.
I don't know what they have in place over there. I mean, they have... Whatever Natalie does is inspect.
That's rental.
Rental. Mm-hmm.
And if it's a plumbing issue, it'd be the plumbing inspector. If it was a, you know, a plumbing code issue.
That's what we kept getting about the bed bugs. Well, it's not a rental property, so it's not, you know, it's not a, you know,
plumbing code
inspection issue. So I guess at some point you just have to say, well, you know, Ames is in Story County, so I guess the environmental county environmental health department will.
And it seems, especially, particularly with the bed bug issue, everybody does that differently. I mean, it's different responsibilities everywhere.
Right.
So it depends upon what, whoever is going to be in charge of that, what they want to do with that. In some cities, it is, the city of Des Moines, for example, it's in their neighborhood inspection program. In the rental inspection, you can lodge a complaint. If it's in a rental facility, but if it's a hotel, motel, then that complaint goes to Department of Inspections and Appeals. But then some areas, it's the county environmental health. Some places, they don't do anything. It really just all depends upon where you are in Iowa, what's done. So there's no set way to do that.
Yeah. Well, I guess we'll have to have further conversations. I'll get some information from you, maybe, and see if I can get a meeting with the city administrator, and just
you should meet with the city board of health. Go to one of their evening meetings.
Council,
yeah.
Go for it. Yep.
I mean, we could go to that. Yeah. We could go to a meeting with them and see.
Okay.
I think the other thing, Margaret, if you wanted me to cover really quickly, was Iowa Public Health Accreditation, the Modernization Act. She had asked me to bring a couple of bullet points on what they're working on, and so if you don't mind, I'll do that really quickly. I am not part of the accreditation process. That is a different area of the Department and our Communications and Planning Bureau, but their updates are they're currently piloting the Iowa accreditation process in Linn and Page counties. Those were requests for proposals that had went out last year, and those were the two counties that were selected because they were a highly populated urban and then a smaller county. Those results will be available at the governor's conference that I believe that Eileen or Terry had mentioned earlier at the end of April, so they're wrapping that pilot process up now. There was supposed to be the accreditation process that was ready to go. I think it was July 1 of 2011, and we kept pushing that off. But there will not be a process ready to go in 2012. Dr. Miller Meeks, who is our department director, who was appointed last January, so she's been there over a year now, had some concerns about accreditation due to her experience with JACO and being a physician. And so she has asked the Public Health Advisory Council and Public Health Evaluation Committee to give her more guidance on accreditation. And so the council and the committees will be working over the summer to provide her answers to questions that she has asked of them. The director is still very supportive of the public health standards, and the work on the standards will continue. There will be some revisions after the pilot process with Linn and Page counties. And so the department will continue to work with local public health agencies on how to best revise those standards based upon what we learn in that process. And then modernization is also continuing to look at building capacity in local health departments about quality improvement. And so trainings will be scheduled for this summer by the department to get local public health agencies the tools that they need to implement quality improvement and continue down the road of quality improvement and modernization. So that was the update for accreditation in Iowa for public health. When we did that, include environmental health as well, or is it?
Yes, when we say, of course, when we say public health agencies, and that certainly means environmental health. So yes, both environmental health and public health, both.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for coming out.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
And lastly, but certainly not least. Is our
sit right back down?
Yes, Margaret James for the Environmental Health Department. Yeah. See, that's what we had to do during the Board of Supervisors meeting. We had to adjourn that and have a drainage district trustee meeting. And then back. I've had three hats on today.
In March.
Yeah.
Margaret James, Environmental Health Department. Here's a table of our numbers. I've switched, instead of quarterly, I'm going to go on a calendar basis because we're meeting now every 2 months. It's just hard to compile that way. So, as you can see, this year we're way ahead of schedule compared to last year, and that is all based on the weather being so nice and systems and wells and all sorts of field activity already starting. In addition to these numbers that you're seeing here is that we have been issuing more notices of violations, and that is usually based on file review, and we see that there has been notes in the file saying that there was an open discharge or a well that was never plugged that we have found in past records, and we're sending those notices out, and we're getting really fast response. Folks will come in, we send them certified, I think that catches their attention, and wow, they come right in, and they're getting those things squared away, so we're really happy to see that. It's really working well for us. For the lead inspection program, I closed a case in Ames the last month. It was a rental unit, a large, older house, and they replaced all the windows in both upstairs and downstairs, so they passed the lead dust test. I still have 8 open cases, none that are posing immediate threats because they are, most of them are vacant right now. And then there were no new lead poisonings reported by Homeward. I sat in on the webinar that IDPH put on regarding the lead grant and how it will also expand to include Healthy Homes initiatives. So the acronym for that is HELP, and it's Healthy Homes and Lead Poisoning Surveillance System. The grant amount, if I have this wrong, Carmely, please correct me, but I believe that grant will be, the lead grant, which will also include the Healthy Homes, will be cut by 25%. So it's kind of hard to, money's getting cut back, but the program is expanding, so that's a tricky thing right there. So HELPS could possibly expand to include lead, radon, carbon monoxide, mold, falls in the house, structural repairs, weatherization, ventilation, pesticides, and secondhand smoke. Some of these things are already addressed by our department, but just in an unofficial basis. For complaints, the last couple of months, we received one from, it first actually went to the DNR regarding a weird algae in the East Indian Creek. It was sampled and BOD showed up around 200, so that's kind of a red flag that something's going on there. Kathy went out and checked our septic system upstream from that, and she did not find any problems with that. So for now, we're going to assume that it was maybe a dead animal in the stream, something like that, that was bumping those numbers up temporarily. And then we'll do additional follow-up if he calls back and says the problem is still there. Mold in a trail up in Story City, sewage back up in Ames, and then one that's been going on for a good 7 months is we have a driller that is retired, but he
apparently put in some wells, geothermal wells, without grouting them, and they are very inefficient when they're not grouted properly. And this came to light when an individual down by Kelly wasn't happy with his bills, and so he had another driller come down and add some loops and then also trench alongside the old ones so that they could loop them all together. And I went out there, and it really did not look like any of the wells were grouted. The old wells were grouted. There's been some reports, some studies saying that sometimes that grout can hit a lateral vein and that way, and you'd lose all your grout. I don't know if that, it'd be hard to believe that it would happen in all of these. So that is ongoing. I don't know how much more we can play into this, because if he's a retired driller, all that we could really do is take his license away, or the state would. We'd work with the state, and he's not interested in having his license anymore. So it might just have to go to a civil court. I don't know. Septic pumper inspection program. Matt finished up the final inspection just yesterday with Grantech down the road here. Really not a whole lot of violations were obvious. No one is hauling milk on the weekend, so we don't have to worry about that with their pumper tanks. So signage was probably one of the major things that he found wrong. And then there were some setback issues, especially with DrainTech, the 750 feet of land-applied septage near a house, or within 750 feet of the house, and that happens to be DrainTech house that they own. So DNR is working on a decision on that. Excuse me. Trainings and meetings. All three of us attended the EOC meeting that Emergency Management put on. I attended the SharePoint webinar, budget meetings, hearing, interagency reviews, homeward. Eileen and I have been meeting on a few things, and then the webinar for the Lead and Healthy Homes. Kathy took the Coyotes test and sat for the exam and is awaiting her results. I'm sure she passed. And Matt, EOC, and then has done quite a bit of online classwork for GIS mapping. And he also attends the NAPS meeting for the department. For miscellany CAFOs, this is kind of a big thing that just hit the last couple of weeks. Story County received 3 new manure management plans for operations with 500 to 1,000 animal unit capacity, and that equates to under 2,500 finished market hogs per site. There's no construction permit for something this size required, only the manure management plan. No master matrix, no public notification required. So what we did is we sent out notices by mail to the owners within a half mile of those 3 facilities. And half mile was arbitrary. In addition to those 3 manure management plans for those new CAFOs, we also received a construction permit application and manure management plan for a forest facility up in that Veering area. This one's going to be an expansion, and it required a public notice but not a master matrix. The 4 new sites then, I don't know why they have 2s on those, but so where the 2s are the 3 new ones with manure management plans. So those are the smaller, the 500 to 1,000 animal units. And then where that red star is where the larger one will be going, the expansion. They're all kind of in around Zeering up there, which is unfortunate for the Zeering folks, I guess. This is a closer look at the expansion of the Ely farm. The one in red exists, and then the green will be the addition. The blue shows the alluvial soils, and they have far enough setback for that, and there is no karst topography in this area. The yellow indicates where the manure will be spread from the Ely farm, the Ely CAFO. And this is a map that Matt put together. Did you want to say anything about this, Matt? No? Okay. Mm-hmm. And so the dark, the gold there is the from the manure management plans, the application sites. So as you can see, we're running into a little bit of a density problem. This is the whole county, and the dark pink shows the application areas. It's the top top row of townships, I guess, that have the bulk of the CAFOs and the manure applications. And this is just a screenshot, and it shows, you know, Story County and then Hardin and Hamilton. And for me, and this is just a personal observation, it just seems like we might be turning into a Hardin and Hamilton with our CAFOs, and that is, for me, not a desirable thing, but that is just a personal opinion. Three presentations were given by the department. The Emergency Preparedness for Environmental Health Regional Workshops, we met again over in Boone County and worked on a response plan. I made a presentation to Tullamore Glen Homeowners Association, talked about wells, septic, and radon for their wells. I am trying to work with them to increase the parameters that they're testing, arsenic, fluoride, pesticides, things like that, because there are several people on these individual private wells, and it's really functioning more like a small town rather than private wells. And then we had the septic contractors annual meeting, and again, we talked about the certification that you all voted on already earlier in this meeting. And I've been working with DNR on the 28E agreement for the well permitting. Right now, it's an expired agreement, and it's just sort of an unwritten extension every year. This came to light because of some of the environmental consultants wanting to have a blanket write-off that Story County would not allow wells to be drilled within a certain distance from left sites. And we are not willing to do that because we believe that takes away the rights of the property owner in the vicinity of those lost sites, leaking underground storage tanks, and also cleanup sites like cleaners, you know, clothes cleaners, things like that. So Russ Pell with IDNR is supposed to be getting me a contract that then I will have Steve Olin review for us. Or agreement, not a contract, an agreement. And I love that picture, so I had to use it again today. Thank you very much for attending. That's Elvis.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Any questions on that? Not this, but anything?
Thank you very much. Okay, next, we don't have any public hearing items. Any staff comments? Apparently not. Board comments? I will just let you guys know that we have appointed two individuals to act as medical examiner investigators. And they will be, I think one of them already is certified, maybe. And the other one will be, so. One of them is a nurse at the clinic. Fritz. Amy Fritz.
Okay.
And the other individual, I can't remember what his name is. He indicated
our pathologist, is it?
That's who the medical examiner is.
Okay.
Dr. Weider.
Right, yeah.
And the other individual is somebody that had been in contact with Dr. Weider, and then an individual at the state office about, he's already got a certification, and he was interested in getting some hours in as an investigator, so that's kind of what, you know, kind of what prompted that. So, but other than that, that's all I've got. And then I would entertain a meeting or a motion for adjournment.
Move to adjourn.
I second.
Motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Meeting is adjourned.